Learn when and how to use four research methods with Marianne Berkovich.
So welcome. I am super excited to see all of you here interested in learning how to talk to customers better. So I assume some people are here because they want to do it at all, maybe haven't done it at all. Some people who've tried it and maybe want to do it better. So today we're going to be talking about four user research methods. And so as a practitioner, you know, I know lots of methods and lots of stuff. And I want to share and focus on particularly four that are particularly useful to entrepreneurs. And so they're sort of the ones that you get the most bang for the buck. So when you start a new venture, there's a lot of risk involved, right? Like, how are we going to do this? Are we going to sort of be successful? A lot of risk involved, a lot of unknowns and uncertainty. And you're going to be exerting some sort of effort to do some sort of research, some sort of development, figure out what's the right thing to do. And there's a couple different ways to approach this. So you could take a bunch of smart people in a room, maybe like your team, and everybody sits in a room and you're like, okay, heads down, we're going to bang this out. We've got some sort of problem that we want to solve. We're going to put our heads together and come up with something. You'll definitely come up with solutions. You'll definitely come up with something. But there's a pretty high risk that what you come up with is not exactly what your customers need, and you might miss the mark. So pretty low effort in terms of you got your team together, so maybe it's just another meeting, another opportunity to work together, but the risk is pretty high that you might miss the mark. So maybe there's another way. So you could talk to users. That's what we're going to be talking about today, is some methods to do that. And this is the area that most of the user research and sort of most of those opportunities fit into that category. And this is really when you're trying to build empathy and understand from a user's point of view what their world is like. Then there's also a different way, that if you want to further reduce the amount of risk but increase the amount of effort that's involved, you can actually co-create with your users. I'll give you an example of this. So there's a venture in the Bronx called City Health Works, where they send community members to help deliver medical care to the community, to help people with diabetes management and kind of other chronic conditions, and supplement what the medical staff is doing there already. The co-founder spent months with doctors, with nurses, with community aides to figure out how to make this program work. It's highly successful. We're getting great patient outcomes. Cost in general for medical care is going down, but it took a lot of effort. So reduce the risk by spending a lot of time with your users, co-creating with them throughout the process. But the trade-off is it takes a lot of effort. So for our needs, why don't we pop back up a level and kind of get more bang for the buck in terms of figuring out what are those critical moments, those key times when we want to engage with our users. So we trade off, you know, how much we understand and how much time we spend with them and the risk and the effort analysis there. So one caveat about all this is that regardless of what kind of user research that you're going to do, it's critical to talk to the right people, which means bringing in the right people, recruiting and talking to the right people. And so for whatever your product is, you need to have a good understanding of what those target users are and kind of what they do. And when I say that, it's not the demographics. So it's sort of a red herring. It's easy to identify people in terms of age or gender or where they live. But chances are, for whatever your product is, those are not the key things that sort of make them uniquely your customers. You know, focus on things that matter a little bit more. For example, you know, I was actually talking to a diabetes management company, and they were talking about people who use this particular drug, okay? So taking insulin in this particular form, that's a lot of people with diabetes, but that doesn't really help you design a product for them unless it's for that particular drug. So a behavior way to identify those folks might be instead to think about somebody who's newly diagnosed with diabetes. Wow, all of a sudden you have a better sense of what are their needs. They're going to have a lot of questions. There might be emotions involved with that. There's surprise. There's anger, you know, those types of things. So understanding what are those behaviors associated with your product is the first thing that you need to do. And if you aren't sure what those things are, before you do any user research at all, I suggest that that's an activity that you do and figure out who are my target users and what are those behaviors that are associated with them. Another thing about that is the right people. So the right people are also not your mom, your spouse, a random person you find at a coffee shop. You need to have a very clear sense of who your target users are, and you can identify and clearly articulate that because it's not just everybody. So here we have a generalized product development lifecycle. You design something, you figure out what it is that you want to make, you then build it, spend a lot of time doing that, and then you launch it. Then you go back through and do it again, an iterative design process, okay? So in each of these stages, user research can help answer some questions. So during the design phase, the major question that user research can help you answer is, what should we build? So all those divergent things, when you're trying to understand the scope of the problem, get a better understanding of your users, what their needs are, what should we build? Understand, have a deeper understanding of what the problem is. In the build phase, you now have a good understanding of who your users are, what their needs are, what the opportunities are. And in the build phase, you have now some solutions. And you can explore which of these solutions is actually the right one for my users. And so this is when you focus on going from the problem to the solution. And is this the right solution? Is there ways that we can iterate or pivot on this solution? And in the launch phase is, did we build it right? So in the build phase, maybe you're exploring a wide variety of solutions. You're like, this could work or this could work. Maybe we put this together in this way. In the launch phase, you've chosen one solution, and now you really want to evaluate, did we build it right? And also maybe scaling up. Maybe you're seeing patterns at a small scale in the qualitative sense, and you want to see if those things still hold true when you look at it in the quantitative sense. So this is where the four methods that we're going to be talking about today fit into where you would use them in the design lifecycle. So ethnographic interviews, creative artifact interviews, usability studies, and surveys. And we can group these by two of them help you really understand and get deeper understanding of what the problem is and explore that. And then two of them are, once you have a solution or multiple solutions you want to explore, how do you validate and understand what the solution is? So one of the things that you'll notice is that focus groups was not one of the methods that was up there. Focus groups are a method, but I find that it's really useful in very particular circumstances. And in general, they're not the circumstances that would be helpful for you. So focus groups are useful to understand people's attitudes and people's preferences. Most of the time, when you're focused on understanding the problem, what you really want to see is behavior. You want to observe somebody actually doing something. You want to see them in context. And so getting them in a focus group, you're really not getting that understanding of how they actually do this behavior and how they do this thing that you're interested in. So that's one thing. Another thing is that it's very shallow, that you develop groupthink, that everybody, when you bring a bunch of people together, people want to be agreeable, people want to sort of, you know, group dynamics come into play. And so you come out with one kind of group opinion rather than the 7 or 8 opinions that you wanted in the room, which was why I invited 7 or 8 people in. So it seems like an efficient way to get data, and it's really not, because you do one focus group, you still come out with one sort of groupthink answer, and then you can't sort of dissect it of like, well, okay, well, how would that work for this particular group type? I don't know, because it's sort of mushed up with all the other stuff that people said. So I suggest focus groups you stay away from, and for a third reason as well, is if you're new to talking to customers and new to user research, just having a one-on-one conversation is sort of, you know, that's enough pressure enough to kind of get it right and make sure that you're, you know, you're asking good questions and to observe and all that type of thing. You now have 7 people or however many people around a table. You now need to manage those relationships. Is this person talking okay enough? You know, is this person, you know, dominating the conversation? Managing a group of 7 or 8 people is much harder than managing just a one-on-one conversation. So this is not a method that's great for kind of people who are just starting out with user research. So I would suggest staying away from it. So enough about kind of the knots. Let's switch to the methods themselves. So the first one is, in that early stages, in that design phase, we're trying to figure out what the problem is. We're trying to get into our users' minds. And so an ethnographic interview is a fancy way of saying it's going to be a structured one-on-one interview. And what's key here is that you want to make it in context. So if you're interested in how nurses do their job, follow them to work, go to the hospital. If you want to see dog walkers do their thing, follow them on the dog walk. Don't interview them in a coffee shop. So the context is really important because it gives you an opportunity to observe and see what people are doing as well as talking to them. And the idea here is to be surprised, to sort of engage and sort of listen and open up your mind to things that you couldn't have heard otherwise. Otherwise, we could have been those smart people sitting in a room. We have all the data that we need in our heads. If we go out into the world, that's our opportunity to learn and hear something different. So ethnographic interviews are good for learning about the problem. So here are some examples of the types of questions that you can answer through ethnographic interviews. And these are just kind of to get your mind going. They're really about understanding that context and understanding from that user's point of view and building empathy for that user's point of view. You really want to go into their world and understand what life is like in their world. So I want to give an example. So last year, I was a fellow at Blue Ridge Labs at Robinhood. Robinhood Foundation is a foundation in New York City that helps fight poverty among low-income New Yorkers. And Blue Ridge Labs is the social impact incubator side of it. And I have lots of examples from that because it's not covered by NDA. The things that we were doing were public. So there's lots of things that I can talk about, whereas some of my work at Google and other places I can't really talk about. So they'll all be from that, that experience last year. So the program itself is for social entrepreneurs, and during that 5 months, you go through the whole process of identifying a problem, figuring out possible solutions, and then taking 3 months to build a solution. And the theme last year was access to justice, and my team decided to focus on consumer debt and maybe people who are being hounded by debt collection agencies and who take them to court for no reason, that type of thing. So we were looking at low-income New Yorkers and consumer debt. And some of the questions that we did to really understand what life is like for folks who are suffering, you know, have consumer debt and being hounded by debt collection agencies, we actually went out and talked to them, and we wanted to understand what their journey was. So one of the things that we did is we started very broadly, and you always want to start very broadly with your ethnographic interviews because you want to get a sense of who that person is, even though you want to learn a particular aspect of their life, like let's say, you know, finances or oral hygiene or, you know, pet ownership or something like that. You don't want to start with that because you're already kind of honing into specifically. So you want to start broadly, you want to understand. So we started with questions about where do they live and, you know, who do they live with and what do they do for fun and what is their work situation like. And that gave us a really nice context of who these folks are before we ask the questions about the part we were really interested in about the finance. And then we can actually bring in things that we heard about earlier. It's like, oh, well, you have, you know, a child. What about how do you pay for daycare? So we were able to connect the dots in their life and get a better understanding of that because we started broadly with understanding kind of from their worldview. So one of the things that we were asking about is once we switched to kind of talking about finances is budgeting and how do people manage money and that type of thing. And so one of the participants said that once a week she sits down and she makes a budget and figures out what are all the things that she has to pay for that week. And we asked her, I'm like, oh, so, you know, when do you do that? And she says, oh, you know, every once in a while. And we're like, would you do that now? She's like, sure. You know, it seems about the right time for me to do it. And so I forgot which one is which, but one of these she actually did for us when we were talking to her. And then another one, she actually, you know, we asked her, I'm like, okay, so once you have this budget and you have a sense of what you need to pay for, what do you do with it? She's like, oh, then it gets put in my purse. And so I think one came from her purse and she had other ones in there too. So we got a sense of how she does this. So for her, it was an organizing mechanism that she does about once a week to sit down and be like, okay, these are the things I need to pay. How am I going to decide what things to pay for? And once that's done, she sort of like keeps the record in her purse. And if she needs to bring it out, she'll bring it out that way. But usually it kind of gets crumpled up in the bottom of her bag and then gets thrown out a while later. So this is an example of, you know, what we found out during an ethnographic interview. So one of the things that we did after this was after we talked to a bunch of people, we were able to make this journey of what kind of getting into debt, dealing with debt, maybe getting sued, that whole process looks like. And we were able to identify opportunities within that consumer journey of ways that we might be able to help people. So for each of these methods, I want to give you a list of do's and don'ts. And these are sort of not your usual do's and don'ts. There's lots of resources out there on how to do user research and how to talk to customers, that type of thing. What I want to give you is sort of the most impactful distillation of things that, like, you know, from my years of wisdom experience, I want to share with you so you wouldn't have to go through that pain and sort of those years of learning. So this is a distillation of things that I think are sort of the key things to getting this method right and doing it well. So the first one maybe is a little bit obvious, listening and observing. With that one, really, it's getting yourself in that mindset. You know, when you have sort of a startup venture, you already have a lot of preconceived notions. You have ideas about where you want this to go. And being really open and really listening and being open to being surprised is a hard thing to do. So really putting yourself in that mindset of I'm going to hear things, I want to be surprised, I want to observe things I might not expect, and putting yourself in that mindset is really important. I'll give you an example of this. Bank of America, a bunch of years ago, they actually wanted to see if they could get, I think it was like middle-aged women to open more accounts. And so they went out and talked to women and had them show how they did some, you know, financial transactions, how they kept track of stuff. What they noticed is a lot of people, when they were keeping track of their spending, they would round up. So if I, you know, spent $4.55 on coffee, I would just say $5. Or if I got gas, instead of, you know, $23.97, round it up to $24. So they saw this rounding up behavior. They weren't expecting it. They weren't testing it. They were sort of just keeping their eyes open to whatever happened. And that led to a really interesting insight, which led to the program called Keep the Change. That was that insight that they saw this behavior and they were able to say, okay, so this rounding behavior is familiar to people. They want to do it. It makes things easier for them. At the same time, that could be a mechanism for saving, and that could be a mechanism for them to open up savings accounts. And so now they can have a reason to open a savings account. So you do your checking and then the Keep the Change part gets rounded up and put into your savings account. Collect examples and stories like the one I just told. So that's really what you're going out into the field for, is to be surprised and to get details. So you can read lots of, you know, sort of, and I suggest you do start with, you know, third-party research or kind of general research that's been done about an area. But once you go out in the field, you want to understand those particular and those specific people. So you want to ask for stories. You want to collect examples. You know, so you wouldn't ask questions of like, you know, tell me about what is parking like for you. You want to hear an example about the last time you parked. What was that like? Or what was the worst parking experience that you've had? So you want very specific and concrete details about something. And because you're in context within a place, you might be able to use the things that are in the environment to kind of trigger some of those stories. You know, it's like, well, what's your favorite thing about, you know, living here? Or what's your favorite thing? People are like, oh, this is my prized water bottle. Let me tell you about when I won it in a contest. And all of a sudden it starts and gets to a better story that might be interesting for you. Asking open-ended questions. Again, you're curious. You want to find out things. So asking yes or no questions doesn't really help you. You know, have you ever parked? Yes. Okay. Where do you go from there? So, you know, tell me about a time when, you know, or, you know, what are all the ways you do such and such? So the more broad and open-ended, and it's fine to have, you know, even like this is one of the tricks I use, is sort of like trailing off, because people hate silence. And so they'll fill in the blanks. So I use silence and sort of trailing off in a lot of different ways. And you can use that also to ask the open-ended questions. Taking lots of pictures. So first of all, get permission. Because if you are going to be in people's private homes or incentive places, or there might be other things going on there. Some people don't want pictures of their children taken. Get permission, but those pictures are going to be gold, because there's that conversation that you had, you're taking studious notes, maybe you also got permission to record. You can't remember everything. You can't remember, what was that artwork on the wall? Or like, did the kitchen connect to the living room? Or did they put that form here or there? If you take pictures of all that stuff, A, you'll have it as a record for your own kind of understanding once you go back. Plus, you can share it with the rest of your team and have it sort of live on and remember, be like, oh yeah, that woman that we talked to, Sally, I remember how she did that, because you have those pictures posted around the office to remind you of what that experience was like. Okay, so now we come to our second method, which is, I call it creative artifact interviews. So this is another one for that exploratory when you're trying to understand the problem more deeply. So with these, you're having the participant create some sort of thing. And we'll get into what that thing is. And for those of you who are introverts or who really are uncomfortable with the idea of going out and talking to people, it makes it a little bit easier. It gives you a little structure to what to do in that conversation. It gives you something to point to that you don't have to look the person in the eye. So I find this is a great technique for folks who aren't super enthusiastic about going out and talking to people. So the kinds of questions that you can answer with a creative artifact interview are actually myriad, because it depends on what that artifact, what that thing that you're going to be creating with them is. But the types of things you can get is like the various parts of something, and especially something that's sort of intangible, or it may involve like a lot of things over time that that one visit that you have with them, you might not capture. So it's really good for kind of condensing time or getting sort of something that's in their head, and maybe even something that they haven't thought a lot about themselves, into some sort of format that you can actually then have a conversation about. So here's an example, again, from the studies that we did with the low-income folks. So we wanted to know, where were people spending their money and how were people spending their money? And so we had them do this balloon exercise, and each of the balloons was things that were lifting them up financially. So sources of income, you know, things that were, the money was coming in, and things that were lifting them up financially. And then the stakes down below, like around here, were things that were holding them down financially. So loans and debts and, you know, car payments and rent and utilities. And so we kind of encourage people to like get more specific about what are all those bills and what are all those things that they have to pay and what are all those sources of income. And we actually had, you know, a couple of participants say like, wow, you know, this is the first time that I've actually looked at this. Like, this is the first time this is an actual visualization of sort of my financial life because it's uncomfortable. It wasn't something they want to think about. And this was actually a helpful exercise for him to do. So it was useful for us, but it was also useful for him too to kind of turn that into something tangible and sort of reflect on his life in that way. So, you know, finances and that type of thing is a little, you know, intangible, a little bit out there. So how can we make it real? How can we make it turn into something, a picture, something that's written down? How can we just make it a little bit more something that we can talk about and have a conversation about? Get creative. So this is an opportunity, you know, because you're figuring out what this thing is beforehand. So you can get creative, you know, it doesn't have to involve like glue sticks and glitter and that type of stuff. But if that's really what kind of brings the activity to life and really kind of gets at this complex thing or this intangible thing or, you know, kind of the pieces of this thing together, it creates a levity and it creates a lightness to the experience that you can use that creativity to unlock some things for the participant. And use their artifact to spark conversation. So that's really what you want, is that it's not meant to be a perfect, you know, representation of whatever is in their mind. And it's really meant to spark conversation. So, you know, when we had the balloon exercise, be like, oh, we can point to over here and be like, so tell me more about this. Or, you know, is there anything else that's missing here? Or, you know, how does this work over here? So it gives you a way to literally to point to things and ask to hear more about those things. A couple don'ts. So don't make the activity overly contrived. So I've definitely come up with some ideas. I'm like, you know, it's like, and then I'll do this, and then I'll do this thing, and then we'll layer this on top, and then this will happen. It's too much. Basically, you want this thing to have just enough structure that they'll create something that you can spark that conversation and start talking, but not so much that it's all about the activity. Now you've got glue coming over here, and you have to wait for the hot gun, you know, and all that type of stuff. And then don't overanalyze the things that they make either. So, you know, if you have everything up on the wall and you're like, oh, everybody put this thing here. It's like, well, does that really matter? Maybe, maybe not. You know, again, this is a way to spark the conversation, to have deeper, more meaningful conversations with people. But it's not really meant to be kind of quantitative data for folks to line up against. All right, let's move on. Surveys. So surveys, there's a lot of pitfalls with surveys that I want to help you avoid because people think that they're sort of simple. They're like, oh, it's just a bunch of questions. People answer a bunch of questions. There's a lot more to it than that, especially because you're not there to course correct. So you don't actually, you need to be very precise about what it is that they're answering, making sure that what they're answering is the information that you need. So they're good for learning about the solution and at scale. So this is the only quantitative method that we're talking about today. All the other ones are qualitative, sort of, you know, on the order of 10 people or less probably. This one is more quantitative, to be like, okay, this thing that I'm seeing, is it happening at a larger scale? Surveys are good for measuring perceptions, attitudes, preferences, not so much behavior. If you want to understand people's behavior, you can either look at session logs at scale, or you can do the usability study. So if you want actual behavior, surveys is not what you want. People can self-report things, but that gives you a general sense of sort of what's important to them. They can talk about their satisfaction, they can report their feelings, but it's not about the actual behavior because people are going to get it wrong. So here's an example of one that we did for the debt research. And actually, we were curious about what resources and the New York City legal system people had used and which ones they had heard of. And so we did this survey asking them about one recent legal issue they had and what are some of the resources that they used. Okay, so some of the do's and don'ts around this. So the do's, know what decision you're trying to make. I've seen too many surveys and too much kind of time and energy get wasted on nice to know information. If you don't know what decision you're going to make and if this information isn't actually going to help you make a decision, probably don't run the survey. So for example, one of these things is known throughout the industry, net promoter score. I find that it's totally useless because you have a net promoter score of 7. Okay, what do I change? What do I do? There's nothing actionable about it. So having a very clear sense of what it is, what decision you're going to make, and that way you can decide what questions to ask around that. And especially, you know, as this gentleman mentioned before, like you get a lot of drop-off with surveys. You want to make that survey as lean and mean as you can. So you want to ask only the most important questions. And so if they're not all helping you get information about a particular thing that you can make a decision about, don't ask it. So you want to be ruthless and cut out as much as you can. Asking about attitudes and preferences. So again, that this is not about actual behavior. You're asking about people's perceptions, their thoughts, that type of thing. And kind of tied to that is don't ask what you can extract. So how many searches did I do last week on Google? You know, I have no idea. I can make up a number. I can select something, right? So people can fill in a bubble. How accurate is that going to be? Is that going to be useful in any way? Probably not. So don't ask people about things that you can extract in other ways that you can find through logs analysis or through other quantitative methods, because it's not going to be useful for you. Keep it short. So again, be ruthlessly short. That the shorter, the better. You know, I try to keep my surveys, like, depends on what the topic is, but have somebody try it out, like 5 minutes top. The longer it is, maybe you're using the wrong method there. Maybe if you have a lot of questions in it, this should be some sort of interview instead. Maybe it should be a usability study. If you have that many questions, maybe the survey is not the right method for you. Use specific and enough options. So this is another one to, you know, pilot the survey also, is to try it out, because you know, you don't get a chance to course correct and be like, oh, well, what about this? Because you're not there with them. So you better have all the options represented, or maybe it should be an open end so they can write whatever that they need there. But you should have a very good sense of what those options are. And you should double check and triple check that your answers don't overlap, that they're specific enough, that you don't have any issues like that, that things are get misunderstood. And that's another reason to definitely pilot the survey. And the way that you do piloting the survey is, it's almost like a usability study, but what they're evaluating is the survey itself. So they read the question, then you ask them, well, what does that mean in your own words? And if you're hearing something that's not the way you intended it, you know that like other people might also misinterpret this question as well. And that way, and you get people to answer it, and then you can discover, am I missing answers that should be in there? You know, are people misinterpreting the answers? That type of thing. So definitely pilot the survey if you have a chance. Okay, some don'ts. So don't ask people to predict the future. So I see a lot of questions of like, you know, how likely are you to use this? Or like, what would you do this in the future? Or, you know, would you use this future for? So people can tell you about right now. They can't tell you much about the past. Like, I can sort of remember the past, but it's not going to be very accurate. And I really can't tell you what I'm going to be like in the future. So you can really ask people about right now, but don't ask them about the past. Don't ask them to predict the future. Don't ask too many open-ended questions. I've seen surveys like this where it's just like block of text, open, you know, end of thing, block of text, open-ended thing. And like, of course, it depends on the survey, but like rule of thumb, no more than two, maybe three open-ended questions per survey. That is it. If you're asking any more than that, maybe you should just have a one-on-one interview with the person, because that's really what you're trying to do here. Because people get fatigued. They're not interested. People want to go through these surveys as fast as possible. They do want to give you good information, but if you're like, oh, you're making it so hard for me, you know, you want to make it as easy as possible for people to get through it. And having a lot of open-ended questions, it just asks for drop-off. Don't ask for things that we usually don't quantify. We see this a lot, and a lot of survey tools will make it really easy for you to do this. So I also ask you, you know, how much do you like dark chocolate? How many people would be like a 7? Right? That's like not how we talk about things, right? So like, why do we ask this on a survey? So don't ask for things that we don't quantify in real life. And so if it's labeled, you know, I like it a little bit, a lot of bit, you know, that type of thing, there's ways that you can find the right wording to label each point, but don't ask to quantify things that we don't naturally quantify. So I think there's the fancy word construct of like, what is it that you really want to know? Maybe it's a preference thing of rating dark chocolate versus white chocolate versus like milk chocolate. Maybe I ask people to rate those things. Or, you know, what was the last type of chocolate that you bought? Or what's your favorite flavor of chocolate ice cream or something like that? So it depends on what the construct is, and I would find the right way to ask about that thing rather than having like a numbered scale. And when you're doing the analysis, you can bring those numbers back in. So let's say you, how much do you like dark chocolate? And you have like from not at all to it's slightly delicious to moderately delicious to like extremely delicious, and you have 5 points. You can then turn those into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 when you do the analysis. But when people are answering the question, what they selected was not at all or extremely delicious or something like that. And then the last one is agree, disagree question. This is another one that we see all over the place. So when you ask somebody an agree, disagree question, you're actually asking them to do two things cognitively. So one is, let's say dark chocolate is delicious, right? So how much do you agree or disagree with this statement? So I have to decide two things. Well, how much do I like dark chocolate? And then I have to translate that into some sort of like agree, disagree scale. So now you've made it harder for me. I have to do two things to answer your one question. So why not ask me about the thing, the construct that you're really interested in, which is, you know, how delicious do I think dark chocolate is? And then having a scale for that from, you know, not at all to extremely delicious or something like that. So agree, disagree questions, it's nice because they're very like space efficient, because everything has that same grid, you know, everything's agree, disagree, you can label stuff. but it doesn't give you good data and it puts more cognitive load on the person to answer it. And then you really don't know what you're getting. So don't use those. Okay, awesome. So thank you so much for coming and I appreciate your time.